Dr. Justin Moore is a professor of neurosurgery at the Harvard Medical School in the United States. Dr. Moore is a 2006 Sir John Monash Foundation scholar, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome him to the program. Justin, welcome to the Scholars.
Thanks very much. Looking forward to chatting with you.
So, how long have you been working in the United States?
So I moved to the United States around the end of 2015. So I had finished my specialty training in Australia, and so I came over. I did a couple of fellowships and then got a job over in California at Stanford, and was there briefly before I got recruited back to Boston, where I'd done one of my fellowships previously. To be a full-time attending here, which for people in Australia is basically a consultant, which is a sort of, an independent physician.
Okay, so you are living and working in Boston.
That's right. So basically, the sort of big pull to coming over to the States was a couple of fold. First was clinically, I'm a what they call an endovascular as well as a open surgeon, which means, open surgery is the sort of stuff most people think about, where we, make a cut, we take out some bone that gets us access to the brain, we take out tumors, we do those awake craniotomies that I'm sure some of your listeners have probably seen on the news before, where we have people talking as we're doing surgery. The other half of it, the endovascular, is actually a very minimally invasive technique where we go through the arteries, and we usually do that to get access to aneurysms, which are blisters on the brain, which can cause devastating side effects if they bleed, including a one-third mortality rate. And so this is a new way of doing it. And in Australia, they were sort of at the start of that. So we were sort of looking for people to get skilled up before coming back. So that's one of the reasons why I came to the States, because I did my training in that at Harvard here in Boston, and they were one of the top, programs in the world to do this. So I learned a lot of techniques in that endovascular field over here. And so that was a major motivation.
How long do some of those surgeries take, doctor?
So I'll tell you, I'm a skull-base specialist. So the other subspecialty training I did was in skull-base and radiosurgery. And skull-base surgery is sort of known as the sort of longest, most difficult cases in sort of neurosurgery. And those cases can take in excess of 14 hours. So they're very long cases. The endovascular cases we can usually get done in sort of 2 or 3 hours. So they're a bit quicker, but it's a long haul.
When you're having a surgery or conducting a surgery for that length of time, how do you stay focused and alert?
So I would say, for me personally, it's one of those things that I don't know if you've read the book Flow, but basically when
I
I
have
get
not.
into it, so it's basically a book that looked into like masters in their field, surgeons, pianists, concert, pianists, that's those sort of people. And it's a sort of phenomena where if you're really good and really into your work, you sort of lose time in it. And that's what happens. It's sort of like you start at 7:30 and you go, and then you sort of look, you say, oh, it seems to be, I've made good progress, I better check the time. And it's sort of like, 6 o'clock at night. So the time sort of just
You're
flies
still going.
by. That's right. The only trick there is, sometimes we can be working, for so long that there is like a slightly increased risk of developing kidney stones and things like this from dehydration. So, you prepare your nurse team to have a closed container with a drink in it, and they can just put a straw through your mask, and you can take water as you go. So it's a bit like doing a
Really?
marathon, I suppose.
It's like a Red Bull or a Gatorade or something.
Well, Red Bull, you don't want the caffeine because it can give you a tremor, but it's definitely it's like Gatorade.
Wow. Are you allowed to take a break during surgery? Like sit down and just sort of collect your thoughts for like 5 or 10 minutes, or that's it? Once you're on, you're on.
You can, depending on like the stage, and obviously sometimes there are, but there are periods where like everything's very stable and you can take a brief break. And at least my practice, I have a number of fellows who are trained neurosurgeons that come, to get that subspecialty training. And so, you can take a break while they sort of keep an eye on things and make sure nothing happens. We can do a swap. So we do that sometimes. So, I'll give him 15 minutes and then he'll give me 15 minutes.
I want you to think back to when you did your first ever surgery, whenever that might have been. Were you nervous or were you calm?
So I would say I'm calm. I have a very sort of calm disposition in general. You know, one of those factors that actually a lot of my residents and fellows tell me, you know, they haven't met a surgeon as calm. So I've never been too worried about it. I have to say I really did like the anatomy dissections when we worked on cadavers. So I felt that I did a lot of that work, and I also did a graduate diploma in surgical anatomy at Melbourne University back in the day. So I'd done a lot of dissection before, you know, I had to do my own surgery. And so I felt pretty confident with that. I would say though that it's always a little bit nerve-wracking the first time you put a cut in someone's skin. You know, you need a lot of confidence to do that, given that, you know, the person is otherwise, you know, appears to be intact and you're doing this to them. So it's a big step, but I felt that I had, like, you know, I'd done a lot of groundwork before I did it.
So who were some of the patients, not their names, but the conditions that some of your patients have when they come to see you, and obviously how do you help operate on them?
Yeah, so these days I see a lot of patients. There's really two broad sets. There's the tumor patients. So some of them have, you know, pretty bad tumors, and some of them have very large tumors. And so they come to have those out, and they come with a variety of side effects. Could be, you know, hearing loss, or they're going weak, or they've had a seizure, or they're confused. So they're all the sort of presentations that I see. Some are lucky and they get sort of caught on investigation for other things, and so we can get the tumors out before they become symptomatic. Most of those patients do very well. The other set are the endovascular patients, and there's two types of those sort of patients. They're the ones that we see electively, which means we've caught an aneurysm, it hasn't ruptured, and those patients usually have stellar outcomes. We can usually treat their aneurysms and they're out the next day. But the other half of the patients that come in when something's already gone wrong, and for an aneurysm, that's a rupture. So they come in, you know, often in pretty poor shape. And we, you know, we're sort of working hard to help them survive it. And then we also have strokes. So I do a lot of stroke work as well. And that involves, you know, we all sort of have this image of a person with a stroke going weak down one side and getting rushed to the hospital. Well, what we can do now, and it's a thing that's only been around for the last sort of 4 or 5 years, is called a thrombectomy, which is where we go up by that minimally invasive route and we actually get the clot and we pull it out and we restore the circulation. And so I do a lot of that as well. It's quite miraculous. Those patients literally could be paralyzed, and then, you know, an hour after the case, they're back. They're, you know, without a deficit. So it's a bit of a miracle sort of procedure when it works and when you're able to have it. So that's the sort of patients I see. So some of them are acute and some of them are coming in with a specific problem.
How do you learn how to do all of that, apart from years of study and practice and training?
Yeah, that's basically what it comes down to. So, you know, it's been one of those, I was sort of thinking about it the other day, and I think I've been in some sort of school or training program since I was 2 years old. So it's sort of one of those things that you're just piling things up, and it's the neurosurgery training program is 6 years, and then you've already done medical school on top of that, and you've also done your intern and your basic surgical training, which, you know, you're a doctor for all those things. So you're often a doctor for more than 10 years before you actually get out as a, you know, undifferentiated neurosurgeon. And then I did multiple years of subspecialty training to be able to do the extra things. And so it's a long pathway.
And what was it, Justin, that made you first think about neurosurgery as a specialty?
You know, I would say it's interesting, because I wouldn't say I'm the typical sort of doc. You know, a lot of my colleagues and people that I know, they had doctors in their family. They went into medicine, you know, with those sort of, you know, preconceived ideas. I was someone that sort of evolved into it. So, you know, going into medicine, I really only started thinking about that seriously when, you know, in year 10, I did a you know, what you should do sort of work survey, you know, did that sort of analysis, ask you a bunch of questions, mm-hmm. and then say, these are jobs that would be good for you. And one of them that came out was a doctor. So I get a doctor and an astrophysicist. And at the time I was like, well, they're pretty weird ones because, you know, there was a lot of other jobs in that booklet, but maybe I should look into these.
So it was a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon.
That's what it came down to, I suppose. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but yeah. And so I was, you know, looked into medicine. I hadn't had anybody in my family in medicine. We actually, at my school, we never actually had anyone go to medicine from my school. So it was one of those things that was taking a bit of a leap of faith. But you know, I did that. And then in medical school, I really clicked with the neuroscience, you know, sort of subjects that we were doing. So I loved neuroanatomy. Mm-hmm. You know, I really was into that. And then I also really loved the neurophysiology. And at that time, it was like, oh, what can I do more of as I go through? And it slowly became a decision between a neurologist or a neurosurgeon. And I was more of a hands-on guy. I always liked to build things and do things mm-hmm. with my hands, build a lot of models and that sort of stuff. And so, you know, got to talking to some of the neurosurgery trainees. My demonstrator at the time was very keen on getting onto that program. And, you know, that's how it sort of evolved.
I'm not sure what I think I know the answer to this, but, you know, if I watch some of those medical shows on TV and I see an operating room and a surgery, I'm instantly turned off. I can't watch. My wife is the opposite. She will love it. So I imagine you're quite okay with all of that, given it's your job.
Oh, absolutely. It's early in medical school. You know, you always get a few people that faint, and you sort of understand that they're probably going to be the psychiatrists in the class. But that never bothered me at all. You know, I actually didn't mind the smell of formaldehyde as you go into the cadaver labs because I knew I was going to be dissecting, and that was going to be a lot of fun. And interesting, and that's the same, you know, it's sort of when I, you know, there's a certain smell to the OR, and, you know, I always feel at home when it's a bit like being in an airport. You can be in an airport in any country in the world, and it's got that sort of airport feeling about it. You know, the OR is the same.
So it does, you're right.
Being in Australia, the UK, or, you know, America, it's got that feel to it, which is, you know, very comforting to me.
Is it like being, when you're a pilot, you can only do so many hours before you've got to take a mandatory break. Is that the same with surgery?
Look, I mean, sort of. So with trainees, and this wasn't the case when I was a trainee, but now there is limits on work hours for trainees, but they haven't extended mm-hmm. that necessarily to attendings. And so it's one of those things that we can end up doing a lot of hours in a row. But because we usually have residents and fellows, you know, and there's usually a group of us, we practice generally with a few partners, we can sort of break it up that way. So even though I would say there's no hard and fast rule, we sort of regulate ourselves. And if we're, you know, if we've had a really busy night, you know, potentially we'd get one of our partners to cover us the next day if necessary. Mm-hmm. Although I would say it's probably more common that we just work through it. And then, you know, you go through the next day, and then at the end of that day, you call it quits. So I've certainly done, you know, my share of sort of 36-hour stints.
Have you ever had examples where going into a surgery, you've probably thought that chances of success were minimal, and after the surgery, you were surprised on the upside that the result was far better than you had thought of and beat your expectations, and that patient has now gone on to, you know, live a great life?
Yeah, definitely, actually. And I would say that this is something that's sort of becoming a bit more common, especially in our traumas. Often, you know, people can come in after a major motor vehicle accident or, you know, a major fall or an assault or something like that. And, you know, they can look pretty devastated. However, you know, I've got many examples where we've done surgery and, you know, they may not pick up initially, but, you know, you see them back a few months later in the outpatient's clinic and they're back at work. So, you know, there's something, you know, it's definitely examples of surprising. And the issue with that is, you know, sometimes you have to battle the sort of nihilistic you know, those nihilistic feelings that come up about patients that are in a very poor condition, you know, to battle through that for a few days and give them a chance. And same, you know, talking to families and other physicians about, you know, holding the course and seeing if the tide turns. So that definitely happens. One of the more recent sort of fascinating things that is coming out is in the neuro rehab literature. It's sort of showing that even minimally conscious patients that may have been in a coma for 4 to 6 weeks, there's a decent portion of them, if they're still alive when they discharge, they can actually make, you know, good recoveries over a number of months. So, you know, it's definitely, I've definitely been surprised. So, which is always nice.
You mentioned going to school. Where did you grow up and go to school?
So I was a Western suburbs kid in Melbourne, and I went out to school. So I went to the local primary school in a tiny suburb called Kealba, which is sandwiched between Keilor and St Albans in Melbourne. And I went out to a high school in Sunbury. Don't ask me why I ended up going out there, but I ended up out there, and we used to take the train out there every day. It was a different experience. And we were sort of from a fairly standard, you know, I'd say middle class sort of background. We did had the yearly holiday to the same place every year. My folks were teachers, and so, you know, education was a priority.
And so when you finished year 12, presumably you had good marks, good grades, and you thought, right, okay, well, let's give medicine a go. Where did you first study straight out of school?
So, yeah, when I finished, I did do well, which was, I was our valedictorian or ducks, which was pretty big because it was one of those things that our school had never had anyone in medicine. So it was sort of a big decision to sort of, you know, plug along and see if, you know, if I could get in from school. And it worked out, and I chose to go to Monash. And there was a few reasons for that. But the main one was, you know, I'd done the tours on the open days, and I really liked Monash. At the time, it was the sort of new approach that's now pretty much the sort of standard approach, which was very systems based and integrated with like problem based learning, which, you know, became big buzzwords later on, and now is pretty much integrated in all the you know, medical schools. But they were one of the very early adopters in Australia, and so I really liked that. It made more sense for me. Some of the other, you know, places at the time were still doing things like physics and organic chemistry as separate subjects, and didn't sort of make much sense to me that you wouldn't integrate them into what you're actually going to be doing, which is healthcare. And so, you know, so that was the primary reason there. And that worked very well. The other reason why is that Monash also gave the opportunity to pursue a law degree if you wanted to. And, you know, that was something that I eventually, well, you had to apply for it, of course, and all those sort of things. Yes. But, you know, it was an option, and I was interested in the law at the time. Again, we hadn't had any lawyers in the family, so it was sort of like an area that I was interested to get to know. Maybe I'd want to work in that area. Options, you could combine medicine and law and do something like a coroner, or there was those sort of things. And so that was another option to do that. So. And so, yeah, that's pretty much why I did that.
So your first degree at Monash, was that a double degree, was it?
So what ended up happening is I got my MD there, and I started also doing a law degree there, and I got my law degree and my MD degree, and I also did a Bachelor's of Science there too. So my first degree was the first thing that I actually got was a science degree, and then it was my MD, and then a bit later was my law degree. So it was a lot of work, and then it was a you know, good reward at the end of all that.
I bet. So how long were you at Monash for to do all of that?
I think I was there on around 8 years in the end. So
yeah, okay.
Which was on the speedy side. That was fine.
And so, how did the Justin? How did the scholarship come about? The John Monash Foundation scholarship. Tell us about that.
So I got very interested in genetics. And so one of the things I was very interested in was neurogenetics, neurogenomics, which, you know, especially the neurogenomics was a new field that was developing. And I could tell it was going to be a major field. And so I started looking at, you know, how I could get involved with that to a greater degree. I always had a very heavy research bend. So with the science degree, mm-hmm. I'd done my honors and I'd done it in Parkinson's disease with a neurologist at the Howard Florey Institute. And so I was very interested in pursuing, you know, something in genomics, something in neuro and something that was going to be high impact. And they suggested I sort of look to do a PhD. And they sort of mentioned a few places that were, you know, they thought were world class. And one of them was the genomics unit at Oxford. Another one actually was Harvard here with the Broad, which is sort of, it's funny because now, you know, I have I work with the Broad and am doing that. And that they also mentioned a couple places, you know, locally, if given that going international was, you know, a fairly, you know, heavy lift. So I thought, well, you know, I should, whenever I ask for advice, I always like to take it. If you're not going to take advice, then you shouldn't ask for it. And so I started looking into these and I sort of selected that the best place would probably be the genomics unit at Oxford. But you know, that was super expensive. And it's not something that I could afford, to do unless I had, the scholarship basically. The other thing too, is they're pretty selective. And one of the things that often doesn't get talked about is the getting a scholarship is also, you know, that helps with the selection because they trust, you know, especially like, you know, an organization like the Monash Scholars, like they've done the screening for you, right? Like it's a big boost.
Yeah,
it's like there's a couple of those programs around that, you know, is really quality stamp. And so it helps you in two ways. It gets you the money that you need, but it also gets you the sort of opportunity to sort of get there. And so that was really, you know, the John Monash had an excellent reputation. And so that's why I applied for it. And very surprising to me, they came through and gave it to me, which was great. And you know, then it was off to the races.
Off to England. What was it like studying over there at Oxford?
So it was fantastic. You know, it was tough as well, but it was fantastic. So it was you know, overall it was an excellent experience. But you know, it's a big deal, and I wouldn't, you know, anyone that's done this sort of, you know, international move knows that it's not something that's, you know, you just do. It's not like a holiday. So it was pretty intimidating. You know, I picked up all my stuff, which was basically, you know, a suitcase and a half. I had very little stuff at that point, and, you know, shipped over. And I remember thinking, like, you know, how am I going to, you know, pay for things? And, you know, I'm going to need to set up a bank account and all these sort of things. And, you know, I think
life
I got
admin.
Down to my,
yeah,
that's right. I think I got down to my last like £5 there before, like, you know, the account clicked in and, you know, I got a transfer of money and those things. So it was a little bit hairy to start with. But once it got going, it was great. And I really sort of took the opportunity not just to do a lot of, you know, academic work, which, you know, the lab is, you spend like, at least I spent a lot of time in the lab. You know, you easily work, you know, to 3 or 4 in the morning, you know, multiple days a week. But it was, you know, you always felt you're on the cusp of something. So there was a lot of motivation there, but also I had multiple jobs there. I got a lectureship position there at Oxford, so I was teaching the medical students there, which was great. I got
what were you teaching them?
So I've done a lot of teaching. Even when I was a medical student, I was teaching the science, and they had behavioral psychology students. So I taught them when I was a medical student, when I was doing my, you know, honors year, my thesis year. And so, you know, and then I'd gone on and as an intern at St. V's, I was teaching the Melbourne medical students there. And so when I went to Oxford, they were interested in having lecturers teach anatomy, particularly surgical anatomy, which, you know, that was just up my alley. And so that's what I was teaching primarily there. I also did, they have a very interesting system there that, you know, is one of the reasons why they're, you know, the institution that they are, which is where we have these small, like tiny classes, we call them tutorials, but essentially it's like you and two students. And, you know, and you could be me, but it's also like the professor,
and that's it.
You know, we take it in turns. That's it. So you get this one-on-one with these very high caliber individuals, you know, so it gives it, you know, it's very expensive system, which was the downside because you're pulling out, you know, professor you know, that amount of time. But, you know, for undergrads and graduate students, I mean, you know, the experience is fantastic because you're talking to the expert and you're not with like 120 other people in an auditorium. So, you know, that was pretty cool. I mean, we did do some of the anatomy teaching was done with bigger classes and then we'd go and do dissections and stuff like that. But I also did the smaller tutorials, which was a lot of fun. And I was also a junior dean there, which meant basically I work with the dean and I was sort of in charge. I was in charge of the undergraduates and graduates at the college. So just to provide a little bit of background, like Oxford's basically made up of, you know, a couple dozen colleges and you know, every graduate student, faculty and undergrad is a member of one or other of the colleges. And so the junior dean works with the dean to help, you know, monitor that and basically, you know, keep the college, you know, sort of running. It's more of a sort of academic, on the academic side of things. But yeah, that was fun too, because I got a lot of interactions with the undergrads and the undergraduate students. It was fun.
And so once you finished at Oxford, did you go back to Australia or what happened then?
So I did. So I had, so while I was at Oxford, you know, we have a very competitive application program to get onto to neurosurgery. So while I was there, I applied and, you know, luckily they accepted me. And so I got onto the program. So basically they knew that when I was, you know, scheduled to finish, so I would finish in the December and I would start on the program in the January. And so that's basically what happened. In the interim, while I was at Oxford, I actually met my wife who was in doing her master's. She's from the States. She was doing her master's now in the same lab. That's right. So we sort of had this dilemma because she had actually started her PhD here in Boston at Harvard. And the question is like, you know, what are we going to do? And luckily she decided that, you know, she has a lot of initiative. She sort of got in contact with Melbourne Uni and she sort of arranged to have, you know, do the second half of her PhD, like co-supervised at Melbourne Uni. So we actually both moved back to Oz. I started the training program and she kept going on her PhD now in Melbourne.
Terrific. And then fast forward, what was it to 2015, 2016, you ended up in the United States?
That's right. So, you know, I'd had a look around and obviously when I was at Oxford, you know, it's funny when you're at Oxford, like the sort of institution you hear most about is Harvard. And when you're at Harvard, the institution you hear most about is Oxford. So it was one I'd heard a lot about.
You've experienced both.
That's right. So, you know, having a look around, you know, we already had, we'd been, because my wife had lived here for a little while when she was doing her PhD, and you know, I'd come here before. You know, it's one of those things that the States is a huge place, and you know, you've got to find the areas that you'd be comfortable to live in and you feel you'd be happy at. And so we decided we like the coasts, which a lot of people do. So and you know, because of the subspecialty training that I wanted to do, there's only a few units in the world that were doing the sort of volume and the cases that I was interested in having the exposure to. Mm-hmm. And so one of them was here in Boston, at Harvard, and the hospital was BI, Mass General. And so I did that. And then when we finished that, we'd already had it scheduled to do a second fellowship in Skull Base, which was the long surgeries. And we had that at Stanford. So we all hopped up.
Off to California.
I should say we did have a baby in the interim while we were here the first time.
Don't leave the baby out.
No, so that we so you know we had to we it was a cross continent with a baby and to settle in California. And you know, California, there was great. Palo Alto is, you know, it's got weather very much like Melbourne, to be honest. And it's also got, you know, lots of gum trees. It's very sort of Australian vibe to it. So that was nice. So we lived there for a few years. And, you know, I finished the training there and I think, you know, my first academic position there. And then the guys back here recruited me back. So we did another cross-country trip and landed back in Boston. Which is where we've been since, and we've had another a couple of years ago. So now we've got two of them, both in Boston.
The sequel.
Part two.
Yes.
That's right.
Terrific. And as an Australian doctor working in the American health system, are you able to provide any observations on the differences between, say, the American health system and the Australian health system?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting, it's a very interesting juxtaposition, the two. And then I also often add the UK because I was quite familiar with the public system there when I was living over there. And so, you know, I would say like the UK system, the NHS is like, you know, super public system. Then you have the US, which is like pretty much a private system. And then, you know, Australia sort of sits in the middle with, you know, a decent public system, but also, you know, a decent amount of private, you know, hospitals around as well. And they all do function very, very differently. And some of the differences are in terms of, you know, volume. Like I would say in Australia, where we're sort of less, we're less concerned about other hospitals. Here, healthcare definitely has a business bend. And so, you know, the volume of patients, you know, and the sort of business metrics are a lot more sort of relevant and discussed. Like I have to say, when I was, you know, when I'm practicing in Australia, no one really wants to discuss any of those things to much of a degree. It's all quite polite.
Yeah. We need some more patients. We need some more casualties.
That's right. So, you know, no one talks about that. Whereas here, the difference is it's like, well, you know, there's like six hospitals in this, you know, radius, and we want to get, you know, the greatest amount of patients that we possibly can out of those six hospitals. So there's definitely more of a competitive flavor to it, I would say. There's also a bit of a difference in the sort of legal system. You know, the states is more litigious, and so, you know, I think that has a bit of a sort of, there's like an undercurrent here that's a bit stronger than in Australia. Although saying that, I think, you know, I think Australia still, you know, definitely recognizes the legal system in the background there. And I would also say like the programs run quite differently. So in Australia, you know, we have a lot, you know, especially in neurosurgery, we have one central program. So, you know, you've got to get on. Like, so everybody in Australasia, so Australia, New Zealand, we all apply to the one program. And if you don't get on that program, well, you just have to wait till next year. You just have to keep waiting. And if your spot doesn't, you know, there's never a spot for you, then you've got to go and do something else. And similarly, if you leave or, you know, something like that happens, well, then that program's done because you would have to, you know, apply to the same program. Whereas here, you know, while there's an overall accrediting system, each sort of hospital has its own residency program. So you go and get that accredited, and then, you know, you basically interview all your own residents, and then you decide who you want for your specific hospital. And so, you know, there's, you know, basically there's, you know, about 100 training programs in the States, and they have this huge match, and we're sort of all, you know, we're all competing, but also all, you know, reviewing the same sort of candidates. So it's quite different to the Australian system.
Well, it's been terrific catching up with you today, Dr. Justin Moore, joining us from Boston at Harvard University. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll be following your career with much interest. It's been a pleasure having you on the program. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.